Good morning. It is just about to turn 9 o'clock, and so all of the summit classes will be beginning at 9. And I'm glad to see some of my students here. I have sent you all the PowerPoint for today's lecture, and if anyone else wants this PowerPoint when we're done, just give me your email address. You can see on the screen that there are three names, and two of my students are also making part of this presentation. Bright Tambara and Ruhika Roy will step up here in just a few minutes and take over for several of the slides that they have prepared on the subject of the youth of Iran and how people in the country and outside of the country are reaching out to them. So that is our subject for this next 45 minutes. I've got 37 slides, so I think we'll be right on time and maybe leave a little bit of time for Q&A. So some basics. You, of course, know where Iran is. There's 82 million people that live there. And the subject for this morning, persons who are between 15 and 24, it's right at 15% of the population, 6 million males, and almost 6 million females. There's been a lot written and studied regarding Iran. Most recently, the nuclear program. Is it a weapons program? Is it an energy program? But also democracy, women's rights, and other important subjects for the region, including terrorism. Our topic today, of course, is the youth and how they kind of play into several of these subjects. And one of the best-known books, not by a Christian, but about the youth in the Middle East, is this book by a man who went on to serve in the State Department and at Google. His name is Jared Cohen, and you can find him on the internet. You can read other books that he has written. But his parents must have been pretty brave, because when he was in high school, he did the Lawrence of Arabia kind of thing, where he left the safety of his home and he went to a foreign land to study something on his own. So he went to 4 or 5 countries in the Middle East, from Lebanon over to Iran, and would just go to the McDonald's, or he'd go to the coffee shop, or he'd go to the streets, and he would live in people's homes, and he would get to know what is going on in the families and what is going on in the youth. And then he wrote this book. And this book was mainly featuring Shiites and what they thought of the world and what they thought of their own governments. And in this book, the world some 10 years ago became very aware that the youth in the Middle East and who are Shiites aren't that different from other types of youth. They like fast cars, and they like Western movies and clothes and hairstyle, and they like technology, and they don't particularly appreciate some of the conservative interpretations of Islam that have been thrust upon them. I've seen this in different ways. One time I was on a plane from Tehran to Dubai, and when the plane landed, all the women removed their headscarves. They just preferred not to wear those, old and young women. It's not to say that some don't mind them, but it was what I witnessed. And they say things like this quote, "We don't like the governments of those other countries, but we do like the people, like the Americans, we like the West." And if you were to go to Iran today, you would find that if you were in a home, you'd be warmly welcomed and fed and given a tour of whatever city that you're in. But because of their reaction to the regime and its heavy-handed penalties for dancing or drinking, there's been a lot of rebellion. And so prostitution and drug use, etc., are a major problem among Iranian youth. Here's some cartoons. Words a little bit small, but this is how we handle sassy teenage girls. "I had the Revolutionary Guards delete the protesters as my Facebook friends. He's twittering." They don't have much of a way to express themselves politically or socially. They do listen to the radio, and they watch foreign TV, and they even practice their English that way. There is a brain drain. They would like to study in the West or perhaps stay in the West or even in the East. When they think about what the religious leaders have done, they say things like what's in this quote, that all they've done is raise the marriage age just a little bit. And they have been very active politically, in particular the 2009 election protests, which were cruelly put down. And right now, as we speak, President Rouhani, who is, of course, subject to whatever the Supreme Leader says, but President Rouhani is in New York City. And there, Iranian youth who are in the city are protesting against his being there. And this is a story from 2 years ago, which, again, if you get the PowerPoint from me, you can read all those small words. But you can see the pride that they take in organizing and in speaking to their government, if their government will listen. And one last slide before Bright stands up and addresses us. With regard to the nuclear program, you might wonder, well, what would a youth, a young professional or young adult in Iran say today about should we have nuclear weapons? Well, they may not particularly believe the Western claim that the nuclear efforts are for weapons. Instead, they take great pride in that their country can progress technologically, all the engineering, all of the physics to come up with nuclear energy for either medicine or for power. And so in that sense, they take pride in what their country has accomplished. They don't like being compared to North Korea. Okay, Bright.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Bright Nambara. I'm a political science and global studies double major. And my interest is the Iranian youth and social media and religious interest. My question of interest is what do you do when there is state-run and tightly controlled media outlets, when the government controls everything that gets out there in the country, when young people cannot express their views, their opinion, especially when they're anti-government. But before, I want to share a few quick facts. 60% of Iran's 82 million population are under the age of 30, so that's a big percentage of the population. The youth in Iran, like Dr. Kot said, are very politically active, especially we saw this in 2009 when they protested. The under 35 years of age population is very pivotal to elections because they vote, they turn out, and this sometimes worries the government because they get to choose who they want, even though sometimes the elections are rigged, but they still really compose a big percentage of their electorate. And there are several youth movements in Iran, which some of them started as pro-government, especially in 1979, but have come to realize that they need to start fighting for the freedoms and of youth and individualism. So going back to what you do, as young people everywhere in the world, you usually find yourself on social media. Young people, if they have no other way around, they will go to social media. Iran's youth is also flocking social media. They're using Facebook, they go to Twitter, they go. When the government tries to suppress that, when they block the internet, they use VPN, which is a virtual private network, which is the best way to stay anonymous when you don't want the government to know who you are, where you are. And this is used by many young people all over the world, especially where there is dictatorship, where young people cannot use internet. So it's a great challenge to the government. They pose a threat, a long-term threat at least, because the more they use social media, the more they get exposed to outside opinions, the more they question their own government, they start to think outside Iran, outside the box. And you may like it or not, this the government doesn't like. However, the irony is that Iran's leaders, they use social media. Here is the current president, Hassan Rouhani, tweeting, "Today is a new chapter to work towards growth and development of our dear Iran, and therefore our youth to dream again for a brighter future." Obviously, a young person in Dallas or Austin, they will see this and be like, hey, actually, this government cares about their people. They care about their youth, their young people. They want the young people to thrive, to have a future. But it's, you may be surprised that a young person in Tehran, Iran's capital city, may not be able to see this tweet, because the leaders do this to showcase or to show the world that we are good people, we care about our young people, we are doing everything we can for them to thrive. But on the ground, young people cannot even see what their leaders are tweeting, how they're interacting with the rest of the world. So this is a challenge for young people, but it's also a challenge for the government, because they don't want to suppress it too much, because when you have that population that's full of young people, you don't want to risk them rising against you. But you also don't want them to be intoxicated, as the leaders would say, by Western ideas or even ideas from the rest of the world that oppose their regime. And my question, my next slide is about the youth and religion. It's also very interesting to read what young people think about their religion. What the, Iran is very... some people say it's a theocracy. Their leaders are very conservative. They're radical in their beliefs, Islamic beliefs. They follow a very Islamic code of law. But young people increasingly question this belief. They may be Muslims, but they're more mainstream in their belief in Islam. They want more freedoms. They want to be... You can see the picture. Some of them have house parties. They go out and they hide. They don't do it very publicly, but some smoke, some don't put veils when they're where the government can't see them. This is not a good idea, by the way. I don't recommend smoking. But it's a sign that they're questioning. They're not in that bubble where the government wants them to follow a strict code of rules. One of the professors said it's difficult to explain some aspects of what's going on with youth in Iran. The youth are different from 10 years ago. And this is a very current comment. It's from the Financial Times. So this sociology professor at Tehran University is wondering what's happening. And what this means is young people have changed. They're not as conservative as the government would want them to be. And the dynamics are changing every day. And their leaders are wondering, the elders are wondering, what's happening? What to do with this? How do we go about the changing dynamics in the youth? That's mostly it, I think, for me. From my personal analysis and point of view, is that it might crumble from within when you have young people aspiring to be free, to have freedoms, and they're the biggest majority of the population. It's a matter of time. Thank you. I'll...
Hi there. My name is Rahika Roy. I am an engineering and poli-sci double major as well. My interests kind of revolved around the youth specifically, as well as underground churches in Iran. And so to begin. So the youth is essentially defined as anybody below the age of 30, specifically between, they kind of look at the ages of 15 through 25. They're some of the most politically active in the Islamic population. They're some of the most outspoken. They pose one of the greatest threats to the theocratic rule in Iran currently because they are so outspoken. They're also very pivotal in the current elections, specifically because the overarching population of Iran is the youth. They make up about over 50% of the electorate, and that number continuously grows, specifically because after the 1953 ouster of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, the death of three students protested became a national holiday at the time. But because of that, there was also a huge baby boom at the time. And today, their strength essentially lies in their numbers. So the power shift itself in Iran and the start of the revolution happened after the 1953 ousting of the then prime minister. It was essentially a CIA coup to get rid of, or in support of the Shah after the CIA-backed coup against the elected government. The young were key players in this coup, or in this protest, and today the almost double numbers of the population from 34 to 62 million have it make it so that a huge section of the population are the young itself. There are huge problems in Iran, however, for the youth, because there is such a big boom in numbers for Iran. They have deep political frustration and dissent, and the first issue is going to be unemployment. There are a huge, vast number of people in Iran, and the government tries to mediate the situation of political frustration and mediate the situation when it comes to unemployment by having government jobs. But even with an advanced degree, and a lot of the youth in Iran do have an advanced degree, they still it takes up to 3 years for them to find a job on average. But the vast number of youth then end up chronically unemployed, which leads to the second problem, which is independence. And this isn't necessarily the feminism kind of independence that most people think of when they think of these countries, but this is the independence in the sense that they can't leave home because they can't afford housing, and so they continuously stay at home with their parents. And this just kind of ties into the third problem that the Iranian youth face, which is sexual crisis and drugs. Social interaction among male and females in Iran who are unmarried are strictly prohibited. Because of that, because it is strictly prohibited and said, or they're told not to do it, rigid restrictions have been created by the government in order to prevent this. But what that means is that an underground social culture has kind of arisen, because they've been told continuously that they can't do something, in this case, interact. So in 2015, the Islamic Republic had some 22.2 million illegal drug addicts. The main drug in the area is opium, but as far as drug addicts go, the majority of them are essentially in their 20s. And so these three coupled together have kind of made it so that there's an increased amount of frustration within the youth. They can't find a job because although the government does provide governmental jobs, it's not nearly enough, and they're quite overqualified as far as the fact that they do have these advanced degrees go. But that leads to high suicide rates, that leads to sexual crisis and drug addictions, and that leads to them staying at home. And because there is a boom, there's also a housing shortage, which continuously puts them in the cycle of staying at home and not actually going out and living in society. So this quote kind of came from the New York Times. It's the same. This is really prevalent in Iranian culture today, in my opinion, that I've noticed in the youth. It's essentially that the Iranian government continuously tells the youth not to do something, i.e., don't do drugs, don't, you know, wear a head wrap, make sure you don't mingle with anybody of the opposite sex unless you're married. And because of this, you see a huge underground culture beginning to emerge. And this is really prevalent with the church movement, to kind of segue in. The underground church movement in Iran has been booming. since the ousting as well. It's estimated that there are more than 800,000 Christians living in Iran, with about 1%, which is about 1% of the population. And that number continuously grows every single year. However, ever since the big political unrest of the 1950s and 1970s, Iranian culture sees Christianity as a very Western thing, and they're very anti-Western culture. And because it is considered a Western influence, it is considered a threat to the Islamic identity. And so, like it says, Iran grew hostile to Western values, including the freedom of religion, which is a very American thing, after the 1979 Iranian Revolution. However, the church scene currently in Iran has been booming and exploding underground despite the oppression. A lot of the times you see people who are coming from Southeast Asia, other countries around Iran, to Iran. I mean, that's also kind of helping the underground church scene. But what happens is that these house churches are created, and it's a very big scene, but they don't actually interact. So they don't actually have the chance to grow and create a bigger movement. And so the process of Christians growing is very, very slow. And we see this throughout Iran. But the other issue is that conversion, right? The evangelical side of things, even whether or not you are someone who is from the religion of Islam converting over to Christianity, you face persecution from that aspect. But you also face persecution if you go back to Islam. On both ends, there's no winning when it comes to these Christians living in Iran. So they essentially continuously live in fear. And that seems to be even more prevalent as the years go on. And this is from the World Watch List. The idea is that there is continuous persecution from the Iranian government, from the Iranian society, towards these Christians. And so these underground house churches never get a chance to really come to the light, and they never get a chance to interact. And so that creates a bigger issue as well when it comes to the growing numbers or trying to grow the numbers. And it also makes everyone live in fear, which, in my opinion, is the biggest thing in the situation, that they have to live in fear rather than be proud of who they are and be proud of what they believe in. And I think that's about it for me. Thank you.
There are several movies about Iran, and my wife and I recently watched Desert Dancer, and it was about an underground dance group of 5-6 young adults who just wanted to practice and participate in jazz, dance, or ballet, or whatever, in a small warehouse setting in the big city of Tehran. But they were so afraid to invite other people, because they thought if other people know we're in it, then it gets out, and then the government will find out, they'll shut us down, and eventually that's what happens in the movie. A few slides building on what our two presenters just now have mentioned. This is from 2013, but Freedom House puts these reports out every year, and I didn't look at the 2016 report. I just pulled up the old 2013 because I knew the answer, that in 2013, it was the least free internet country, because it's usually at the bottom or the very bottom around the world for those countries that they're able to measure. And so that causes frustrations. It also causes trouble in communicating with each other. Also realize that Iran does have a long history with churches, Catholic churches, Armenian churches, Christian Assyrians, and some of these churches are still alive today. Not many of them are as large as that building there on that hillside or as well-kept as that one. Many of them are small, in homes, small groups, and you can't get a permit to improve them or perhaps repair the roof the way it needs to be. And so they are historic in the sense that they've been around maybe for a while, but they aren't part of the present day. They don't have a lot of attractions to some persons who are in the underground churches. Also realize this, that there are groups that are reaching out to the Christians who are inside Iran. And these groups are reaching out from outside to the country. And you've heard of their names. such as Voice of the Martyrs. Perhaps you haven't heard of In Defense of Christianity, and that is a group that in just the last 5 years has arisen. It's a lobbying group here in the United States, but it also has members in Middle Eastern countries, and a number of Christian groups such as the Vatican are involved in that. And they're trying to keep Christianity from disappearing from the Middle East. No one really knows if it's 800,000, if it's 400,000, if it's 100 million Christians in Iran, because they don't do a religious census. And the people in those groups don't want to be known. And so the real question really comes about, if you want to know how many persons are in Iran's churches, or who are Iranian and who want to be in the church somewhere else, there's only one way to know, and that's to get involved. What can congregations and individuals do who have an interest in befriending Iranian youth and changing their lives for the better? So that's the purpose of this slide and what follows for the next several minutes. As you look at this list of 7, 8, 9 things, you might be thinking, oh, well, my church, we do World Bible School, or perhaps we know someone who is a missionary in Greece. Well, that's the starting point. That's really the starting point, because it may be difficult, time-consuming, expensive to do all these points, and I'm sure you can come up with other ideas. The important thing is, what are you doing? What can you do? World Bible School teaches people around the world, from the United States or from other places. It doesn't matter where they are. If they've got an internet connection or if they've got a mailbox, you can exchange Bible class lessons. It's just teaching a basic Bible. World Christian Broadcasting is located in both Alaska and Madagascar. And from the Madagascar shortwave site, these are both giant shortwave stations. The antenna is as wide as a football field. That's what the Cowboys needed last night, right? A very wide football field. Anyway, sorry. The World Christian Broadcasting programming is designed for Arabic speakers and others. And for those who are Farsi speakers or perhaps know French in Iran, they can listen to some of that programming. You know, encourage people in your congregation to learn a foreign language that you want to use to reach out to others. And so why shouldn't we spend some money to send someone to learn Farsi? Because then you can communicate via telephone, via internet, etc., with people who know that language and don't know English. And when I write here, support mission efforts at the edge, what I mean by that is, if it's not safe to go into a particular place, well, associate yourself with others or position yourself near that place. And one of the best places for reaching North Africa and the Middle East right now are places like Athens, or even in Dubai, where you can find some freedoms. And some other places, but that are around the Middle East. In Athens, there are a number of churches and nonprofits. And, of course, the EU is friendly to this also, that allow proselytizing of persons coming from multiple countries who are trying to get into Europe. Well, those persons, for the most part, will not go back to where they came. But they have friends there and they have family there, and they can easily communicate with them if they happen to become Christian. Support refugee outreach. And I'll show you some pictures here in a moment of what my congregation here in Abilene has done. And that is, when refugees come your way, whether it's here in Abilene or whether it's in Europe, you help them. And you give them that cup of cold water. You give them food. You give them clothing. You give them rental assistance. You help them get to the doctor. And if they are interested in learning about Christ, then you follow up with that. Here in the United States, in Los Angeles and Michigan and other places, there are large communities of Iranians, including youth. reach out to them, and they can reach out to persons back home. Now, my congregation doesn't do this next bullet very much, although there are people in my congregation that have gone to Israel and gone to Egypt and gone to Turkey and other places. But just promote the knowledge and the history of those places. Iranians are very proud, and they should be, of their history. Because when you go back to Cyrus and the cylinder that he wrote and gave so many people partial freedom, and when you think about the mighty empire that the Iranians have, they have much to be proud of. The present-day mullahs tend to think that time started at Muhammad. But this history before Muhammad is so rich, and so many of these youth are proud of it. And then, of course, pray. Pray for Christians everywhere. These are all things that we can do to help. One of these places that's kind of at the edge, I know the UAE is actually very much in the middle of the Middle East, but it's so open compared to most places there, is a preaching school. And there are a number of preaching schools at the edges of the Middle East. And this one happens to have a number of persons from India and the Philippines and other countries who have come to Dubai to help with the building boom. And, of course, if you've seen pictures of Dubai or if you've been there, you know that the buildings are just fantastic. I mean, it's Dallas on steroids. It's just incredible. And this particular preacher training effort, they take people who come there and work, and then they go out into the work camps and they preach. They're allowed to do that on lunch breaks and things. And then one day when they go back home, they've got a preaching certificate and they've got a job that they can work. So that's an idea also. Probably all of us in the room are on Facebook, and this is a posting from over a year ago that you can find her. I put it in bold. She doesn't mind you looking at her pictures or contacting her. Our congregation here in Abilene found out about Reggie. She's here in the middle. Reggie Heiler, and then Garrett Krosnick, who's in the light blue shirt there, and what they've been doing for almost 10 years, just on their own, in Vienna. And they befriend people on the street who are in a building that's a refugee center that the government has provided, and they feed them and they visit with them just several times a week, and they just become acquainted with them, and they say, hey, do you want to talk about the world? Do you want to talk about life? Do you want to talk about the Bible? And some of these people do. And so this particular picture, Hamid is a fashion designer, and he's in the striped shirt, and his son is an engineer in the light blue shirt. And then there's a lady there on the far right who's another volunteer. And they do this several times a week. So we thought, hey, we want to give money to that. Here are two other young men, one from Syria, so he got an Arabic Bible, and then one from Iran, so he received a Farsi Bible. And so the interior designer that you saw a picture from a year and a half ago, you can see that this picture was taken just a couple weeks ago. Well, over a month ago now. And he is still in Vienna. He hasn't been moved to another city in Austria, and that's what the government in the various European countries will do. They won't keep everyone in the capital, and they'll send them to other cities within their own countries, and they've got to learn German if they're going to stay in Austria, and then they're going to have to eventually get a job. So he's got 2 years to get fairly proficient in German. So he already knows a home language. Now he's got to learn German. And so why not give him a Bible that's in German and Farsi? Okay? And so that's the point of this particular posting by Reggie. And then she also says, if anyone else has money they can send us to buy more of these specialized Bible, please send it on. So we appreciate her and Gerhard and the other people in their churches feeding and housing and helping them get to the doctor when their child is sick, You know, if the baby carriage for the twins is broken, go get another baby carriage. If someone has an immigration hearing, helping them with, you know, transportation costs on the subway to get to that hearing. And if they get sent back to the country of origin, say if it's Italy or if it's Greece, because the EU has decided that's going to be the case, then to meet with them and pray with them and to say, whatever God's will is, wherever he takes you in this world, we can still stay connected, and you can be a Christian there, even if you're going, it's not particularly your will. So the last couple of slides, I would say that this semester in my class, which these two students are in, it's a special topics class, Iran and nuclear weapons. And so we're talking about Iran and the alleged nuclear weapons program. And all semester long, you know, the bad guy is the supreme leader, Khomeini. But he's really not the adversary, is he? He's sick. He's old. There'll be another Ayatollah after him. The IRGC, which is the military in the country, will continue to control the economy, and they'll continue to do the unfortunate things that they do. And they will still take hostages, and they will still be involved in terrorism. But that's not what we really have to worry about, because our real concern is what's eternal and these youth. So when you think about Ephesians chapter 6, put on the full armor of God, so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil. And whether you're in a prison, or whether you're persecuted, or whether you aren't allowed to get a job, or whether you're getting lashed because you were dancing, if you are a Christian, you can take solace in the words from Philippians chapter 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. So those are the thoughts that we have this morning. I'd like to pause now and see if you have any questions.
You suggest that the military has the real power in the country. Is that likely to change?
No. It's a very short answer. Professors aren't supposed to give short answers. But that is the answer in Iran until there is some sort of an uprising. I don't want to say the word revolution, but I just did. Until the people really force a change, then the grip that the military mafia has on the country, it's not a theocracy like you would think that there would be high and mighty, you know, aspirations for the people. No, instead it's a thugocracy, and they have become rich and fat and happy at the top, and if they can keep the masses controlled, they will. And right now that doesn't seem to be changing. In fact, right now Iran's presence in the Middle East is growing, and that's not good for the Middle East. And if you ask these two good students questions, they will also answer.
And sort of follow up from that, these rulers, these military rulers, their motivation is not necessarily theological.
No, that is correct. They will have a Shiite sheen, if you will, and they will participate in prayers, but the vast majority of the population does not participate or go to mosque on Fridays, and so they go through the motions to keep their job, but they they're not in it for the religion. I guess it's the very stark way of saying it. Yes.
Do you know Hormoz Shariat and Iran alive?
I know of that, but I don't know much about it.
Okay. They do broadcast 24 hours a day, of which it goes not only there to other places, but into Afghanistan. And there be ways to participate in that, which is headquartered in Dallas. He's a member of the church in Carrollton.
Which church is it that sponsors him? I can look it up now. You said Carrollton.
I think you can almost see it from George Bush.
Okay. So I've heard of that. I've had time to look into it.
There are many. In other words, they have Church 7, which people who participate in that, that does broaden contact between these house churches. That for so many of them, Church 7 is their church, which they do it where they broadcast. Of course, they are able to interact because of the technologies of communication nowadays. Everybody has a dish, which is illegal. Everyone has one.
How are these particular churches talking? Are they talking outside the country, or how are they communicating?
They communicate with Iran Alive, and then they actually do training. They do discipleship training.
They pass their messages through Iran Alive and not directly? Okay.
Harmos and others will bring about groups coming out, or individuals coming out and doing in discipleship with them outside the country.
It's good to know.
And there's so many there that are so courageous. She had mentioned the fear. They serve without fear. I remember one individual saying, because he was distributing Bibles and transporting Bibles, that, okay, you can we can go to prison or die for this. And he said, okay, and the people trying to get him to stop, and he said, well, if they kill me, I just get to go home. So he's not afraid, you know, I'm going to serve. And another thing that comes out of the Middle East is, I am invincible until the Lord is finished with me. And so with courage, they go on and do. And of course, so many times when they maybe should have been caught or arrested, they're not. Because the Lord is taking care of that. But the time can come when he's finished with you and you get to go home.
That is good.
And it's a good way for us to live here, too.
Absolutely. Yes?
Do you believe the American government had any culpability in not standing up for the Iranian youth after the 2009 elections? The beatings, the killings from the Baji, beating all the university students, the ones trying to tweet about freedom and liberty elections.
We do have 1 minute left.
So I'm sure you do.
Yeah. The role of governments is never perfect and never will be. Some governments are better than others, and ours is one of those. And we have the ability to have a say in that, and that is good. What happened 8 years ago was difficult, as it would be in any place. I mean, right now in Myanmar, there is fighting between Buddhists and Muslims. How much should we speak up for that? Well, the answer that you would hear from the United States government is that we don't have much of a national interest in that corner of the world. But we do have a greater interest in what happens in Iran. But there was also... at that time, this concern that in 1953, the United States and MI6, the British, were seen as being too involved in what the Iranians themselves also wanted, and that was to get rid of Mossadegh and get the Shah back. It wasn't until just a couple of months ago that the United States State Department actually released its historical documents from 1953, because we're trying to be sensitive to the Iranian government, And it's a question of how can you convince a bad actor to do something that would be correct. Last year about this time, my students are aware of this, a Princeton PhD student who had permission to study the history of Persia from 100 years ago left New Jersey and went to Iran and did his work for a short period of time, but then they arrested him, even though he had permission to be in the country. And so what does Princeton do and what does his family do? They stay quiet for almost an entire year, and so does the United States government, to try to work behind the scenes to get this Chinese researcher released, who's an American citizen, Chinese by nationality. He was recently charged with, and sentenced to 10 years for being a spy. He's not a spy. And so how do you deal with a hard situation? So in 2009, should the United States government have pushed harder, supported more? I can tell you this, that you may not have read it on the slide, but about Jared Cohen, he was in the State Department at that time. This is the Obama administration. And he said, tell Twitter to not go down for maintenance, because Twitter is how the people in Iran are communicating with each other on the street. And Twitter heard that message, and good for them. So it's a tricky question anytime there is a revolt somewhere else, and how much should your government be involved? Thank you for being here today, and thank you for one more question.
I would like to tell everybody that, we have a booth out here for World Christian Broadcasting, and they have a really good new DVD.
Okay.
What they're doing and trying to get further in.
We are dismissed.